Today's sponsor is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shark. Welcome to the Movies, Films, and Flicks podcast. I'm your host, John Lossowith. Joining me, as always, are my co-hosts, Mark Hoffmeyer.
You want to know something, guys?
I do.
I made an amazing discovery yesterday.
Does it involve lakes, Venice, sharks, or Dolph Lundgren?
No.
Okay. I have no idea what it could be.
So here it is. So, I found out, I was going through my Blu-ray collection, and I found out that on the Street Fighter, the Legend of Chun-Li movie, there is...
You have an unhealthy obsession with that movie.
There is a commentary with Chris Klein on it. And so if you've been listening to this pod for a while, you know I'm obsessed with Charlie Nash. Well, Lazvath and I are, of Charlie Nash from Street Fighter, the Legend of Chun-Li. It's a... performance by Chris Klein of American Pie fame, and it's ridiculous. But I listened to the commentary. I want to give you some heads up for it.
So is this like commentary, like DVD commentary of the whole movie?
Yes.
Is it as Nash?
Yeah. Oh gosh, no, that'd be amazing. But since I am, you know, a sane man with limited free time, and you know, I'm not insane, I just fast forwarded to the scenes that he was in because I figured they would talk about, you know, the moments that Nash, Chris Klein, was in. So what I found out was the director thinks his cast is really great looking and that Chris Klein did a lot of rehearsing for this film. And this is going to kill me because for a long time I've been like really trumpeting this and not making fun of it. I just think it's a really insane performance. So I feel like he just didn't care. But turns out Chris Klein was very earnest about this portrayal. And he was like rehearsing and worried and nervous. And he brought his dad to set. Aww. And like... he was like, so I don't like this performance anymore because it's so ridiculous. But he was like really earnest and he wanted to do a great job.
It makes you feel bad.
It makes me feel real bad. But I did learn that Chris Klein loved the pad thai out there when they were shooting. They were in like, you know, Hong Kong. He loved the pad thai. He was nervous at first, but he wanted Charlie Nash to be very confident but not morose. All right. Now, this is really weird, but during a lot of the scenes, Charlie Nash would be like, hey, guys, we got to go. And then the director would be like, you have such a nice delivery. You are a great leader in this scene. And Chris Klein would just be like, oh, thanks, man. Like, I really appreciate it. And you're like, but he said one line. So he did a lot of his own stunts. He ad-libbed a scene about gold handcuffs. And there's this scene where he has to stick a gun into a guy's mouth, and he was worried about knocking his teeth out. So he was really kind about that. And at the end, the final scene that he did, right? Or one of the final ones, it was really bad for him because he was hungry. He hadn't eaten all day. So the scene is about three lines of dialogue, but he couldn't complete it. So the director saw that he was struggling. So he let Chris eat because he was losing it. So he went and ate, and then they finished the scene. And he was told by one of the directors that his line came across as warm and sincere.
Oh. Yeah.
So, hold on. That makes me maybe lose respect for this role, but I never really had much, to be honest. I wasn't that fond of this movie. But so you thought that he was kind of just like coming on the set, kind of, you know, fast and loose, having fun, shooting from the hip, like Kurt Russell in Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah.
And when really, like, he was going like full Shakespeare.
He thought this was his Raging Bull.
Yeah. Like, and they were like, you know, he was nervous. They were talking about always moving the story forward and like, oh gosh. And, you know, like, you know, sometimes like you go into like a very swanky place and you're like very kind of haughty. You're not like, but if you go into like a dive bar where there's just like people laying on the floor and a couple pool tables, you like kind of act out a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I figure like, well, at least I was, because I was a maniac when I was younger, but, I figured Chris Klein like saw that this set was a mess, so he just went, screw it, I'm gonna have some fun. But like he was like really stressed, and if he was hungry, he couldn't hit his lines. And like,
so wait, is that why Kristen Kruk was like so emaciated looking?
Yeah, I, no, they didn't talk about that, but that really made me sad.
Chris she Klein always just looked kept like that,
but I just gotta tell you guys, I've been talking about this film for a long time, but I think it's time to retire it. And to retire it, I'm gonna sing a song by Green Day. I hope unpredictable, but in the end, that's right. I hope you had the time of your life. Chapter closes.
That brought a tear to my eye.
Does that mean you're not going to watch it again?
No, because there's no more fun.
I don't know.
I'm not like a mean guy. I can't sit. I have a hard time watching things and just being mean about it. You know.
What was it? Last episode, we were talking about, like, we had a question. Is Dwayne The Rock Johnson going to win his first Oscar before Leo DiCaprio gets his second? And so now I'm wondering, like, Chris Klein, man, 20 years, not one nomination.
He was great in the movie with Matthew Broderick, Reese Witherspoon, Election. He was really good in that.
Oh, God, I don't even remember. I remember,
and he was like, that movie. That's like the best role that he could be in, like this like real earnest guy.
Well, I liked him in American Pie a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I think when he's playing Ernest, not Ernest P. Worrell, but when he's like playing just like a nice like dude, I think he could, if he got with the right director again, like if he got with David O. Russell, who everybody in the David O. Russell movie gets nominated for an Oscar. Like the guy who delivers pizza gets nominated for an Oscar, you know, with like Three Kings and Joy and American Hustle. But if I think he could do it if he's, and people are like, you're an idiot. He could do it if he gets the right director and has like a very earnest supporting role.
Yeah.
That's an interesting thing to start off our Cinco de Mayo episode. By the way, listeners, like we're recording on Cinco de Mayo, but by the time that you have access and are listening to this, it'll probably be like, you know, Quince de Mayo. Yeah. And so, yeah, you know, screw like the it'll Cinco de Mayo theme of the day.
August de Mayo.
So I inadvertently compared him to Kurt Russell. I don't know if I did that or if you initiated that, but
you did that
just today. Okay, just today.
Folks, oh, quick, say hi to everyone, John Levigood. John Levigood, say hi to everyone.
Oh, hey, folks. I'm the one running my mouth now. Yeah. But like, if you look for recent threads from the Reddit, the horror Reddit, people were asking what they thought their top ranked John Carpenter films were. And I take a look and I was really pleasantly surprised to see that I'm speaking fast and loose. I'm not giving real numbers, but I feel like 75% of the people had at least two of Kurt Russell's roles in the top three of their top five. Oh, yeah. And a lot of people were just arguing over the order of Big Trouble in Little China, Escape from New York, and The Thing. Most people were just like, in other words, it seems that inadvertently people were picking Kurt Russell's John Carpenter movies as John Carpenter's best movies.
Yeah,
how fun is that?
All right, so this is gonna sound insane, but
Feliz Cinco de Mayo.
Yeah. All right, so. You know that scene in Love Actually when Keira Knightley realizes that that guy's a stalker and he like walks away with like his hand on his head and he's like walking
Andrew Lincoln from The Walking Dead.
Yeah. And he's like walking through like the hallways and he's hitting things and he looks like he's really thinking and freaking out. That'd be me trying to come up with my top five Carpenter films, like just walking like on like the beach and on piers and like slapping walls and like just screaming at people, like just crying. I don't think I could come up with like my legit top five. It'd be so tough.
You know, it's Cinco de Mayo and Kurt Russell is almost wearing a sombrero in The Thing. So I think it should go to that.
When Kurt Russell's kids get, oh yeah. When Kurt Russell's kids get married to the videographers, just film him.
That's what I would do.
Just because he's a fan. He's not, it's just like Andrew Lincoln. Yeah.
And the Dido song plays. I won't sleep.
He's going to be standing there in his tank top. Sleeveless.
It'll be Tyrese Gibson will come out and do the singing. Yeah. Because that guy, the guy who did the singing at the wedding in Love Actually, at first I thought it was Tyrese.
Really?
Well, just, you know, he looked like a, like an in-shape guy. He had just the right shape of the head and, like, those kind of narrow, like, sleek, like, damn good-looking eyes. Like, I just thought it was Tyrese at first. And he's a singer. I don't know. I mean, he was a rapper, but it's...
I'd be so mad if my best man just, like, hired people and didn't tell me about it. You know what I'm saying?
That came off well, though. That came off pretty well. I think that was...
That dude's a creeper.
And now he's killing... walkers.
That's right.
Slash biters, slash other weird, stupid words that people have for them.
Gummers.
So I noticed one other weird thing, by the way, today, just flipping through movie social media. Did you know that the new Power Rangers, they just released the image of what the new Power Rangers are going to look like as a group instead of just like promo shots? They look like the Guyver. You guys remember that when Mark Hamill was the Guyver in 1990? They made a live-action movie out of the anime, The Guyver. He was like this bio-engineered suit that became part of him, and he fought monsters. It was really, really dark and weird, like cool movie. But the Power Rangers, if you do a search for the new Power Rangers and you do an image search for the Guyver and you just take off the spine on the Guyver's head and the eyes and just look at the way the armor looks, it looks like they're wearing armor that is a part of their body, like they were built in a lab.
Well, it kind of comes full circle, just right? Because, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Power Rangers show was basically all the fight scenes were recycled from a Japanese kid show, if I remember correctly. So, I don't know, it all just comes kind of full circle, right?
And actually, that show that you're referring to, I know what you're talking about. I feel like that might have hedged off of Ultraman.
What about Godzilla?
Oh, yeah.
Godzilla was 1960 or 50s, maybe.
Yeah, because like a lot of the bad guys were just giant monsters. It was basically just a Godzilla battle.
Yeah. Ultraman would get giant, but he kind of had like – it looked like a cross between the Rocketeer, the Guyver, and a Power Ranger. And he would fight monsters, but he goes way back. Like, I think he's pre-70s almost. Like, so, and he looks a little like the Guyver and like a Power Ranger. The Guyver is like the lowest common denominator. I mean, Ultraman might be the lowest common denominator of all this stuff.
Yeah. I hope it goes full circle. And like Godzilla, the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers take a nap after big battles.
Just... Well, full circle is if the Power Rangers fight Ultraman in a future movie.
And then they both take naps.
Yeah.
They all take naps.
You know, to digress really quickly, like you talked about Ultraman.
Oh, now we're going to digress?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, no, just really, really quickly. Just
staying on a theme.
You mentioned Ultraman. You guys know Steven Spielberg is working on the movie adaptation of Ready Player One.
Oh my gosh! Yeah.
Shut up. That's right. I didn't know it was him though.
Yeah, yeah. There's a, you know, for those of you who don't know, the book makes a lot of pop culture references. Ultraman is one of them. There's a scene in the book where you actually see Ultraman show up, and he grows like full form. There's like a huge fight, and like I would love to see a Steven Spielberg directed. Like a fight scene starring Ultraman. That would just be amazing. I don't know.
I want to see Ultraman fight a giant, like, skyscraper-tall Steven Spielberg.
And
he looks just like Steven Spielberg today. Like, he got blown up. Like, Honey, I Blew Up the Kids.
Yeah.
Except then Ultraman has to fight him because he gets cranky. I don't know. Maybe he didn't eat for a while.
No, I think if I remember correctly, in the book, Ultraman fights one of the Voltron characters, so it's like total like a geek orgasm thing going on there. Yeah,
I think Steven Spielberg could throw down.
Yeah, I don't know,
because to work on these sets, you need a lot of stamina.
Oh yeah, he's worked on some pretty serious sets too.
Yeah, that's right. He's had to slog through mud on Lincoln.
Yeah. All right, guys. I think you know, speaking of digressing, maybe we should digress even further and answer listener questions. Living good.
We should just digress.
Get back on track to digress.
Yeah. Get back on track to go.
We haven't been on track other than introducing ourselves. Yeah. All right. All three of my listener questions come from three members of the same family in Camden County, New Jersey. First question comes from Jesse, and he asks – what is the best surprise they know how to fight scene? For example, Sharon Stone in Total Recall or Gina Davis in The Long Kiss Goodnight.
Between these two, I was just kind of thinking about it, and there are others, but it was definitely Sharon Stone, because when I watched Total Recall, I think I was probably 10. So I probably hadn't seen the trailer for it. I just kind of popped it in. So like when she knew how to fight, I was like, oh my gosh. Like I felt bad for Arnold. But Gina, I guess I just saw it from the trailers. So like that kind of wrecked it all. You know what I mean? Like that let Reich, I was like, oh yeah, Gina can fight.
Yeah. You know, so Mark and I are about the same age, right? We're both like 34, 35. So when Total Recall came out, and I saw that in theaters twice in the same day with my dad when I was 9 years old. So like I'm at an age where I've just kind of learned that women are attractive, but I don't necessarily know the plumbing yet, I guess. But either way, I see this cute, you know, this attractive woman, right? And then all of a sudden she's kicking the crap out of like my action movie icon. So like that blew me away that, you know, like I'm just discovering, oh, she's a pretty girl. That matters to me now. And she's kicking Arnold's butt. Like if she curled up into a ball, she'd be the size of his pecs.
Yeah.
And she's like kicking him in the face.
And her character was so much better than Kate Beckinsale's in the remake.
Oh, yeah. Now, I mean, her hair didn't look as fabulous, but, you know, she wasn't married to the director.
So mine is that they both could fight. But remember in The Princess Bride where both guys switch hands? Like, they start.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like, they obviously can fight, but they could really fight.
That is one of those things where even though we know it, I still like have such glee when that happens when I rewatch the movie.
Because like they were both messing with each other at first and they're like, ah, I'm not left-handed or I'm not right-handed. Like I love. So they went from they could fight to surprise, they can really fight. And like that's like my favorite. Like I don't know why, and I know it's not like out of the blue, like, you know, I know Kung Fu. Yeah. But I love that. That scene. Oh, well, ooh, I got another one. Wait, Lazarus, what do you got?
For me, the first and only thing that came to mind was Bob Barker from Happy Gilmore.
From Happy Gilmore?
Like, I know it's a joke, but still, tell me you weren't surprised when you first saw that. I'm like, oh man, that old man's throwing down. Yeah, the price is wrong, bitch.
Like, now that was in the trailer, but how amazing that would have been if you were like in the theater and you didn't see that coming, and then that fight scene just breaks out.
Oh, I never saw it in the theater. I remember renting it and like seeing that for the first time. I'm like, oh wow, this is so cool. Yeah,
that was amazing. That's perfect.
Oh, he was throwing some pretty good jabs there.
he was working.
Yeah,
like, yeah, they were legit jabs. Like I need to watch his footwork. But you know,
how old is this movie? Like. Because Bob Barker,
96,
like
94,
96-ish. Yeah, between those. So, yeah, I mean, it's 20 years ago at least.
Wow.
I think you're right on the 96. Billy Madison was 93 or 94.
Right, right.
Yeah, and this came out after Billy Madison.
Yeah,
96, 20 years ago.
Oof.
So I think that Jesse really nailed it. Like, when he presented the examples that our listener question provider, he gave some amazing ones. For me, they were actually both characters who we knew could fight, but it was the discovery of elevated fighting, if you will. Like with Neo, it wasn't when he learned Kung Fu for me. It was when he learned he was the one in part one. When he's in the subway and he's fighting Agent Smith, I still remember seeing that movie with my cousin. And like, we're loving the movie. The Kung Fu's crazy. He knows Kung Fu. That's fine. He's beating the crap out of things. But when he realized he was the one and he turned sideways and was fighting Agent Smith with one hand, like, we were just crapping ourselves with glee. And did you not like that scene?
No, but like imagine fighting Neo and go, please don't realize you're the one. Please don't realize you're the one. Please don't realize you're the one. And you're like, let it be the next guy. Let it be the next guy. And then he realizes it and you're like, no.
He's like, oh man, have just kept saying that.
I should have been quiet.
Another one for me though was Tobey Maguire in the first Spider-Man. When he's discovering his senses and he learns that he can – it's almost like perceiving things in slow motion, how he has his super fast reflexes. And the kid goes to punch him in the school hallway and he dodges it. And when he dodges it, he watches the punch go past him. And then he turns his head and looks at the guy throwing the punch. Then he turns his head back at the fist throwing the punch, all in slow motion. And it's like, that was the moment he learned how to fight, or realized he knew how to fight. And at the same time, like, that was when we learned that he learned that he knew how to fight. We all knew he would eventually, but that was a really exciting moment. Like, and it was a lot of fun, and we didn't know what would happen.
Yeah, and he could collect stuff on lunch trays really well too.
Oh yeah,
he was really good at that. I question the physics of how each of those items, though, after they landed on the tray and didn't bounce whatsoever, how they stayed there when he lightning quickly moved it laterally. Like,
that's how I learned to juggle, actually. You guys know that story?
No.
No.
When I was in elementary school, this I had a crush on this girl, and she dropped her tray, and I went to catch it, but I just started throwing stuff in the air by accident. So I was trying to grab at everything. Little do I know it, I'm juggling a chicken sandwich, a carton of milk, some Frenton online.
Oh man!
I'd like to think you're making the sounds of like the French acrobats, like
the Benny Hill theme song is playing in the background.
Like something caught on my foot, and I'm going. And people are like, you either knew how to do that or you got really lucky, you know?
Why can't it be both?
You know, between his examples and our example, do we have any others? I couldn't think of any others.
I think the most gangster one was in Snatch, where Brad Pitt knocks out when they're first at the Pikey camp. There's a big fella. There's a big fella. We got to say about it. You want to cut it, man? That's me, mom. Oh, yeah. Me, mom. Like the first fight, and he just knocks him out with one punch. Like, I knew he was a good boxer. But, like, I didn't see that coming. I was like, oh, my gosh. Like, just blanked him out with one punch. So I thought that was pretty cool.
That was pretty awesome, yeah.
Yeah, but,
Our second listener question comes from Jesse's mother, F. And F has a follow-up question. And her follow-up question is, on that note, why do vampires rise up out of Sunnydale Cemetery knowing jujitsu?
Well, they don't know jujitsu.
Well, you know, they know martial arts. She doesn't. Yeah. They all fight.
If you want to get technical about this. Jiu-jitsu,
but in Buffy, pretty much every evil creature in Buffy knew how to fight.
Yeah, they're like kickboxers. Yeah. But I was like watching it through them, like, because I just didn't want to get like corrected when I said they don't know jujitsu. So I watched a lot of the fight scenes and like, I didn't see any arm bars, but
they're pretty aggressive. They're not doing the defensive peaceful art. They are,
and most of the time it's like a few against one. So like you don't like, you know, if it's like, you know, Buffy does not want to use jujitsu, but that probably could have worked on her if a couple of them knew it, get like a leg lock while the rest jump on her.
Yeah,
but
there were not a lot of submissions in Buffy.
No.
No one tapped out in Buffy.
like there was a couple throws, but that was more on her end.
I think there was an irregularly high number of sneakers to the face for jujitsu.
I kept thinking this was like a trick question. Like, I was like, does someone get a rear naked choke or an omoplata or like a go-go plata or like a heel hook? And so like I watched through the best of videos on YouTube and I'm like, oh no. But they know how to throw high kicks. I don't know how they do that.
I think that's the only thing they do, right? Because I'm thinking about all the fight scenes I saw on Buffy, and the only thing I remember is just Sarah Michelle Gellar throwing out those high kicks.
Yeah, she was winging high kicks. Yeah. And I think the vampires, since watching all these clips, they know how to high kick, and they know how to like look like they're about to hug you, but they're trying to punch you. That's how wide their punches are.
Yeah.
Like
they're just wild haymakers.
Yeah, they're windmilling is what I call it. They're like spinning their fists. And then they know how to get kicked in the face really well.
Yeah.
To know how to do that, don't you just stand there?
Yeah.
Yeah, that actually made me think of Blade 2. Remember Blade 2? It was the one with the Reaper vampires that unhinged their lower jaw. And, like, these things, right? Like, so the head one, the head bad guy, this albino thing, it was played by Luke Goss, who actually also did the albino-looking Prince Nuada in Hellboy 2. But so this guy, right? He was doing some straight up kung fu. He was doing a lot of narrow, quick, fast maneuvers. They were only strong when like Blade was injured, and then he kind of went WWF with jumping, dropping knees and jumping, dropping elbows. But at first he was like practically wushuing this crap like Ray Parks. And I'm just thinking, like, okay, look, you're a vampire, right? You're living your vampire life. In Blade 1, most of the vampires could not fight. In Blade 2, like, they're the two spy vampires that are infiltrating his place, like wearing like black snake eyes G.I. Joe suits with their katanas. They're fighting like crazy. Like, they're trained just to kill him, and then like the prince vampire is fighting Wushu, whatever. Like, all of a sudden, all the vampires know how to fight. Like, I guess they picked up, you know, the complete collection of Buffy is what happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they learned it. Like,
can I ask you a question?
Like William Scott did in Bulletproof Monk by theater.
What would happen if a vampire in Buffy the Vampire Slayer threw a straight punch?
Oh, it would just be a winning punch. Like, because no one would ever see that coming.
Like, Buffy would be like throwing high kicks. She doesn't even block. Like, I'm watching it. Like, she puts her hands down a lot. But if a vampire who has super strength, Buffy's chin isn't super strong. If a vampire just went like, you know, like right jabs, left, like, you know, straight left, like right in her chin, Buffy the Dead Vampire Slayer.
Oh.
Probably, but luckily they telegraph or smoke signal those punches about as obviously as Van Damme doing a jump spin kick.
Yeah. But the bad guys in his movies, they don't move. The final villains.
I think it's because Van Damme gets the crazy eyes before he jumps. Like, he's looking you in the eye when he kind of like puts his arms out to the sides and squats before he jumps. And he's giving you the crazy eyes.
Wait.
And you're just locked onto the crazy eyes. He can be in the air for 3 seconds and you won't move.
Is he like Ka from the Jungle Book? Is that what you're saying?
Like, I guess so.
He hypnotizes you?
He was a crazy guy in the jungle, by the way. In what was it? Not
Welcome
Bushwick.
To the Jungle.
Welcome to the Jungle. That's right. That was the name of it.
So the answer is straight punch?
Yeah.
Straight punch, Van Damme, Welcome to the Jungle.
Right.
We got fun and game.
All right. All right. Thank you once again for those wonderful listener questions. I think, we didn't really answer them, but it was still entertaining, as per usual.
I mean, I think those vampires should have learned jujitsu.
They know martial arts. I now get it. Okay, wait, bear with me here.
Yeah.
So there, that hole in Sunnydale, it's coming from like what isn't it basically a hole to hell?
Yeah,
it's sort of a hole to hell, right? Mm-hmm. Okay,
or a blood rave club.
I'm forming a hypothesis. I'm positing it right now, probably for the first time that anyone ever had it, that hell is populated by every Shaolin monk that ever lived. You're thinking, well, they're so peaceful and pure, why'd they go to hell? But you know what? Living up in those mountains, they paid $0 in taxes, and those tax collectors weren't. So they were just like straight up like cheating their taxes their whole life while living a blissful life. And so they went to hell, and then they taught all the vampires and monsters and demons their Shaolin Kung Fu.
Or they're training them wrong in hell just so they can get killed and come back down to hell so they can have a laugh about it.
They're intentionally treating them to throw wildly obvious haymaker punches, right? Yeah. And Van Damme kicks, but without the crazy eyes, the hypnotic crazy eyes.
They're training them wrong.
They're trying to get attrition through this from not paying their taxes for life. And they live to be very old, so they cheated on a lot of taxes.
Yeah.
Now, see, for me, I think it's like a situation similar to Neo when he downloaded all those martial arts styles. I think when you become a vampire, you kind of download all those files, but they're corrupted. So they're using outdated and corrupted software.
They actually just uploaded all the WWF footage instead of actual like kung fu, like Bruce Lee.
And Power Rangers, all the moves and Power Rangers.
Imagine that. Like, you have these terrible, like, the evil vampires from 30 Days of Night are coming at you, right? And you're like, man, they're going to rip me to shreds. And then all of a sudden they're like, hi-ya! And then they start missing punches and, like, getting themselves winded with spin kicks that are telegraphed easy. And then I just run away.
Well, I think that we had a lot more fun than I even would have anticipated. So thank you to Buddy and F for those questions.
Yep. All right, Mark, I think you have a topic for us this week.
Yeah, so speaking of spin kicks,
I'm watching the jungles.
Yeah. Of what?
Of Welcome to the Jungle.
Yeah, speaking of like Welcome to the Jungle and spin kicks, actually they have nothing to do with each other, but recently my wife suggested a movie called The Hollows, and we watched that and we liked it a lot. So I kind of picked up this forest vibe, but then I, you know, like it's about this woods, whatever. But then I watched The Forest, which is about the suicide forest in Japan. Then I watched Green Inferno, which is about a bunch of idiots going to Peru to stop deforestation. So I kind of started thinking about forest horror and what constitutes, you know, that genre. Like there's house horror, there's body horror, there's what other horror is there? Torture porn, mm-hmm. comedy horror.
Just plain, you know, most slasher movies are really thrillers and don't have that supernatural element. So you kind of have that slasher thriller horror.
Yeah. And so there's just so many genres. But today I kind of want to talk about forest horror. And to do that, we're going to talk about some of the newer releases. But I guess with forest horror, it's basically where, you know, the forest is a character like in and of itself. Like these are movies that like there's this Cabin in the Woods horror as well, but these movies don't really fall in the Cabin of the Woods.
But you see, with the Cabin in the Woods, they're using the cabin that happens to be in the woods as an isolating mechanism, right? Yeah. But when you look at Evil Dead, it has the Cabin in the Woods trope. However, the forest functions as more of just a filmmaking or writing device to isolate you. It provides its own threat. It is, like you said, it's like a pseudo character.
Yeah, and so I was just looking through Bloody Disgusting. Here are their top 10 forest horror movies that take place in the woods. Number one is number 10 is Antichrist, which Lars von Trier, and it features smashing genitals with wood and cutting off things and
deer
hanging out of things and baby death and
really horrifying.
Yeah,
that movie makes the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre or the remake, what have you, seem like something you should show kids at a nursery. Like it's so brutal.
Yeah, but you know, in it there's like this crazy tree. You know, he takes her to this camp, this wooden house called Eden to kind of separate. It's a long story, but that's 10 is Antichrist. 9 is The Hills Have Eyes, which I think is more of like it's more of a desert.
The Hills Have Eyes is the New Mexico desert.
Yeah, okay.
I think that they kind of confused that with the wrong turn.
Yeah, yeah.
There's some shrubbery there, here and there.
Yeah, there's some like rolling tumbleweeds.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a tree.
Yeah, there's some greenage out there.
Some foliage.
Mm. I don't think there was anything green in The Hills Have Eyes, unless it was a green t-shirt.
8 was Tucker and Dale vs. Evil, which plays... It's fantastic if you haven't watched it. It does take place in the woods. Actually, the woods does have a character in it. Like, the woods do kind of play a character because just the way people die in the woods. But, you know, they kind of use a cabin. They kind of play on the whole trope of that. Number 7 is I Spit on Your Grave, which, you know, it's about a woman who moves to the woods, you know, in a cabin to be alone so she can write, and she gets attacked. The next is Blair Witch Project, which I think is a true...
It's almost as if the forest was making them get lost. Even if that's not what was intended, it could sometimes feel like that.
Yeah, yeah. And so definitely that. Next is Dead Snow, which is like a Swedish or Norwegian zombie film.
Norwegian, yeah.
And that definitely plays with cabins. It plays with like, you know, Evil Dead type stuff. And it takes place in an isolated cabin in the woods. Next is Cabin Fever. Which is takes place in the woods, in a cabin. Then they have Friday the 13th, Sleepaway Camp, and The Burning, which are just camps in the woods.
Just isolated. Yeah.
And then Cabin in the Woods is the next one. And the number one forest movie of all time is Evil Dead 2. And if you think about the plants and – but he opens up the book, though. he opens up the book, and that's what kind of starts everything, you know. But the – forest does have a
So we have the evil, basically rape tree that we covered in the past. I think it was episode 37, the trees you wouldn't want in your front yard.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the tree that basically was attacking, like trying to eat him at the end. And then there was the evil spirit, and it's all POV going through the woods. So it almost seems like the woods is what is to be dreaded as much as whatever Ash sees that we don't. Yeah. And then, like, what made that bridge go? It could have been as far as I'm concerned, it was the evil woods.
Yeah, and I think the woods are a character in that, and that's very successful. And then I was trying to look back at, like, the first movies that take place sort of in the woods. And there's a movie called The Old Dark House, which is in 1932.
Ooh.
And then you jump to Spider Baby, which is a weird kind of abandoned home in the woods in 1964. Then you have Equinox, and then Deliverance, which I think is, you know, it's a thriller, but it's also, I mean, you know, it's pretty horrifying. And it does have the backcountry type vibe.
I mean, if I spit on your grave in Last House on the Left or horror, then Deliverance is horror.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's,
and then there's The Guardian in 1990 with, like, the tree that eats babies.
Yeah, the dryad witch thing. That was cool.
And then there's also other movies. You know, Pumpkinhead takes place in the Appalachian Mountains. Creature of Darkness, a direct-to-DVD thing about kids on ATVs and bog fog.
Fog. I like that that rhymes.
The genre has been around for a long time. And I think one of the reasons why there's so many low-budget films, if you look at a lot of these movies, you know, Hills Have Eyes, whatever, I Spit on Your Grave, Blair Witch, Cabin Fever, Evil Dead 2, you know, Sleepaway Camp. One of the best parts about shooting in the woods is, if you think about it, there's not many sets to build. Yes, you are on location, but there's not many extras unless you're at a camp. But if you're strictly in the woods, you can go out there and you can use the same square mile for all your sets. So I think for horror, there's definitely a nice low budget vibe to shooting in the woods or the forest. I mean, obviously you're in the forest, it's a pain in the butt. You got to get catering out there, bathrooms, but a lot of indies don't worry about that. Like I doubt Wes Craven cared too much about that when he was making his films. But I think the reason that's so popular in horror is that, I mean, it's there, it's cheap. There's not much to lock up. You think about Willow Creek with Bobcat Goldthwait, where they go out in the woods. It's just an easy way to keep things cheap. And that's why it's been good for horror. The Hatchet movies, actually.
And you know, they don't feel cheap.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's built-in production design. You know, like, the trees are there. And if you have a good cinematographer, it's going to work. But the movie we're going to talk about now just was released. I call it dumb horror. And it is called The Forest. It's stupid.
Could you please elaborate as to why you call it dumb horror?
It's just a bunch of
there are a lot of stupid movies out there.
Okay, it's about a dumb who gets a feeling that her dumb sister is lost in the woods in Japan. In Japan there's this place called the Suicide Forest, and I don't think a movie should be made about it because dozens of people kill themselves in this forest on the base of Mount Fuji every year. So it's about these dumb-dums who meet some other dum-dums. She's American. She goes to Japan. She's a dum-dum. And she, like, orders food. She orders it wrong. And she sneers at everybody. Like, I lived in Korea. Like, when I ordered food, I didn't order what she ordered. And then if, you know, like, I was trying to use metal chopsticks and I wasn't using them right, the lady took them from my hand, gave me wooden chopsticks. I was like, I get it. You know, I wasn't like that ugly American. And so she goes over there. She orders her food wrong. She's all annoyed with the country. She doesn't like any of the food, so she eats a bag of crisps. Oh, potato chips, right? And then she goes to this trail to look for her sister, and everyone's like, listen, do not go off the trail, okay? People kill themselves. There's crazy people out here. Stay on the trail. The dum-dum goes out there with some other dum-dum. She goes off the dum-dum trail, right? This dum-dum lets them stay there all by themselves. She starts seeing things because she's a dum-dum because she got off the stupid trail. The dum-dum that's with her, she'd be like, yo, this dum-dum's crazy, but I'm a dum-dum, so I'm going to stay with her. You know, she's a dum-dum, so she kills the guy dum-dum. And then she's an idiot. She thinks she sees this hallucination because she's a dum-dum. Then she slits her wrist. And it turns out that her dum-dum sister that was teaching in Japan actually survives. So this dum-dum is stupid and dum-dum.
Wait, so her dum-dum love interest, right? So when she gets to Japan.
Aiden.
Yeah, I love that his name is Aiden. Like, it's almost like in the 90s when every frat boy character was named Kyle or something. It's...
Shout out to our listeners with the name Kyle.
Look, it wasn't as cool if you were 18 in the 90s to be named Kyle to me. Yeah.
And now here's the director, right? This is his first film. I think he's written some things before, just a dumb. And he wanted this movie to – I don't know this guy, so if he ever calls me up, I'm not going to call him a dum-dum to his face, obviously. Yeah. But he wanted this movie to be like The Ring, but then he wanted a lot of jump scares. So Natalie Dormer, who showed a lot of personality in Game of Thrones, she can act. She has a personality. In this movie, dude, I'm serious, the whole time she's like, I have to find my sister. I have to go to Japan. Who are you? You're a reporter. I'll trust you immediately.
Well, he was white.
Yeah. Hey, hey, I'm going to go on this trail. And all these people are telling me not to leave the trail, but I'm gonna go off the trail. And the editing in this movie, right? It's all like 3 seconds too long. So it shows like Natalie Dormer walking in the woods. And it should cut. But then it keeps on her face another 3 seconds. And this whole movie is her eye acting where she's like, looking around the trail like a dum-dum, like her head's going everywhere. Like, I'm like, you can act. Like, you don't have to act when you're hiking. Just walk. You know what I'm saying? Like, don't trip on foliage. Yeah.
I got to say, I agree with you that in this, she was generally horrible. But I mean, I'm a Game of Thrones fan. I think she's amazing.
Yeah, she has personality. Like, but see,
she's really impressive.
I think the director wanted a tone, right? And then he probably watched half the movie and went, oh, shit, this is terrible. So then they started throwing in dumb jump scares where, like, characters who aren't even part of this movie are jumping out at her. Then she goes, and then it's like back – there's a raccoon that jumps out and goes, bah! And she's like, ah. Like, it's just really bad. And, like, I remember watching this movie, right? I was bored. I was working out during it. I was doing stuff in the background. I'm glad I rented it because I think I was – yeah, like Megan was out of town for a few days, so I'm like, I'll just watch this stupid thing. So I was like cleaning. I was cleaning the floors. I was like, you know, kind of, you know, watching. I was in the same room with it
to help numb the badness of the movie.
And I remember at the end, right, when she like, so like she's freaking out. And I'm like, she's obviously seeing things. I remember saying to myself, I go, what a dipshit. And I listen. She's a good actor. I think the director just wanted like this crazy, dramatic the ringtone.
Oh, there you go.
That's like from One Missed Call.
Yeah, and like it's like, guys, you know, just, and this is crazy because it's about this white girl coming to this Japanese jungle and talking about how these Japanese kill themselves there, and it's like, come on, like it's just so like, and she's just like, she's not nice. Like, she never tries to speak any Japanese. Like, we're going
She's not a sympathetic character.
Like, we're going to the UK soon, and, like, Megan is, like, teaching me, like, Welsh words. Obviously, they speak English out there. But, like, we're learning some, like, the local dialect just to, like, impress people in pubs. You know, like, whenever we travel, like, anywhere, I learn how to say please, thank you, where's the beer? Hey,
it's fun. It's polite. It's adventurous. It's practical.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, like, just, arigato, soju. 30, arigato. That's thank you, right?
Yeah,
arigato. So just doesn't – there's nothing. This movie, I don't know how you sat in a theater and watched this. I know, John, you said you saw it with a friend, but what were your thoughts sitting in this theater?
So a lot of times, even when a movie is bad, I am not analyzing its badness during the movie. In other words, I'm not coming up with the things I'm going to mock or kind of analyze when I write a review later or when we discuss it later. While I'm watching the movie, even if it's bad, I'm in the moment. You know, I'm in the movie. This movie, a lot of times when movies have hallucinations, right, where someone is being toyed with, they have some kind of a mechanism that they'll use to let you know she might be hallucinating. Even if the idea is to make you question if they're hallucinating or not, they do something to kind of cue you in. It's either a red herring or there's a weird sound or, you know, the color scheme changes. It seems like a dream sequence or surreal. You know what I mean? Like there's something that happens. Or they just woke up, so you question if they're really awake, right? There's a cue that lets you know, hold on. Are they really seeing this? Well, she's walking around with Aiden in the forest, right? And by the way, of course, he's about her age, built not like a journalist who's hiking around in the mountains far from free weights and good looking and American. But let's brush that little bit aside. They're walking along, they're chatting, and all of a sudden she hears something. Okay, well, she looks and, oh, look, there's a little schoolgirl waving at me out in the woods. And then when I say, hey, little girl, she smiles, turns around, and darts into the darkness. Now, they're delivering this with a totally straight face. So when she goes and follows it, you just think, you, I'm going to use my F-bomb, you fucking idiot. Like, that's all you can think is. And then, like, later when it's dark and they're like, don't go out there when it's dark. And she sees, like, three little schoolgirls come out of the woods, cross the path, and then go back in the woods on the other side of the path. Like, it's totally normal. Well, like, if I just saw that, it looks like they know what they're doing. Like, would I really follow them? Give me a reason. Give me a pitch of a fever dream to believe something weird is going on. It's not until we're too deep down the rabbit hole that, you know, enough of this stuff has happened that we realize that anytime she reacts to pretty much anything, it's probably a hallucination.
And if you're Aiden, you're going to be like, yo, this girl's crazy.
Well, yeah.
He would have been like, I'm going to get out of here. You know, but I like what you said. That's how you get arrested. It's like, if I see somebody walking normal down the street, I'm not going to run after them.
But another thing is that they seem to know exactly where they were going. So it's not like, you know, it would have made a little more sense for me to believe it if you're not going to pitch a fever dream or have her just wake up or kind of just snap out of it. Like, you know, maybe there's a change in her sentences. What if instead of holding hands and la 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 crossing the path like it was totally normal, what if it was a girl running as if she was running from something or scared of something?
Bees!
They're just looking desperate. Yeah, Tommy Boy it. But, you know, like looking desperate. Well, you see, then you incite urgency and you eliminate the option to think. If that is someone who needs help, you need to go now or you will lose them. Right? You don't know what they're scared of. You don't know what they saw. You don't know what they think. You don't know what they've been through. So, like, that is a good device. But a little girl waving you, waving, and then turn around and run. We're playing the chasey game. I'm running away into the darkness. Like, that's just, what is happening?
If I'm the ghost, I'm like, check out this dum-dum. She's following me.
It's almost like the ghost is like, look how dumb. Hey, other ghosts, shh. Watch how dumb this girl is. Look, I'm going to wave at her. Now I'm going to run away. Let's see if she follows me. And then she just follows him right into forest hell. And then she follows him down into a fucking cave. Sorry, that's twice. I got to stop that. She follows him down into a cave, like a la Star Wars, where he sees like the Vader phantasm. Like follows her into a cave. And then she's just stopped in the cave, like 20 feet away with her back turned to her. Like that's just creepy as hell. That would make anybody nervous. And she's just going up like, oh, totally normally. Oh, hey, little girl, I see that you stopped. Did you need help? Oh no, what a shock. You look creepy. What is going on?
And you know what? The woods are scary at night when there aren't demons in it. Like, if you're in the woods at night, it's scary.
Dude, what was the name of that Bigfoot movie that we saw? The Bobcat Goldthwait.
Willow Creek.
Yeah.
Willow Creek. Great example. A lot of people knock it, but we both thought that was a fantastic tent scene at night. It was like 10 minutes of them being scared. Amazing. Yes. The woods are scary alone.
Yeah. Like, I don't need some little chill ghost walking around. I'd be like, you know what? If I saw some chill ghosts, I'd be like, what up, guys? I got my own problems. I'm in the suicide forest. Leave me alone. You see my sister? She looks just like me. She's a dum-dum, too.
This movie just – it wasn't having it. And, you know, the getting lost, they kind of staged the getting lost. I understand, like, setting the stage for the premise, right? But they really, like, were just hitting us in the head with a hammer with the, oh, you'll get lost. Don't be here at night. No walkie-talkie. They're telling you all this, like, five times in a row just on her first walk in the woods.
Yeah.
And then they're immediately breaking all of their rules
yeah.
for her.
It's basically like, just a dumb American
being dumb and dumb. So like, yeah, and you're right though. Like, I don't know. When I traveled, like when I remember when I went to China and did like the whole hiking thing.
Mark, before you finish your story, I think now's a good time to go on break. But I promise, when we come back from break, Mark will finish his exciting story of when he went to China.
And saw some dum-dums.
Stay tuned.
When I say pod, you say...
pie.
Wait a minute.
Whoa, what's
Robert,
going on, Kyle?
Take your headphones off real quick.
Okay, sorry.
John, what the hell is this?
I don't know. Robert invited me over.
I don't know. This is kind of awkward. Are we doing like a promo or something?
I don't know. I wish he'd put on his pants, though.
Yeah, he's like dancing around. He's talking about Sharp Dropper.
I think he's looking for the baby oil.
Anyways, Robert, what are we doing? Huh? What are we doing?
What was that? I can put my headphones back on?
Yeah.
Oh, we're doing a promo for Shark Dropper.
Oh, okay.
That podcast we do that has improv, and we just talk about our daily lives and stuff.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
I still wish you'd find your pants.
Where can I find it?
Oh, wait. Are we supposed to wear sharkdropper.com?
Short shot time.
Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. All right. The moment you've all been waiting for. The moment where Mark finishes his grand retelling of his trip. Was it China?
Yeah. So okay. I was kind of interested in this movie because, you know, the woman, the sister, the dumb sister taught English in Japan, and I taught English in Korea for a year, and that allowed me to travel, you know, to Japan and China. But what John was talking about the journalist and how like he looked like really ripped, like in shape. But when
like
I,
you.
But when I went to China, right, I had a broken finger. So I had like a massive, cast covering it that I had gotten from soccer. I had a beard and I had like nowhere to stay. So I didn't want to bring anything nice. So I actually brought a CD player with two CDs. I brought one pair of jeans and I brought like maybe three shirts and a sweater. And I like wore that the entire time I was out there. So I looked like a total dirt bag. Like they wouldn't let me.
You know, the old vision of the hobo with like the stick and the bag hanging from the stick.
Yeah.
Like you had that much stuff.
Yeah, I had a cheap backpack because I'm like, listen, you know, the only thing I need is my passport and like, you know, some money. So like I kept track of those really well. But I'm like, if anything gets like taken or if I lose anything, I don't really care. Because, you know, like the Tiananmen Square, they weren't letting people in anymore. So I like jumped the fence. Like, so, you know, when something closes at 8 p.m., they stop letting people in at like 7:40.
Yeah.
So I like jumped in. Like I went up the Great Wall of China, went down the long
way. You just described like the beginning of a horror movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, closing it at a certain time and you're like, this is stupid. Yeah. You jump the fence and then you learn why they close it at 8 o'clock.
And then like I saw a guy get the living crap beat out of him really late at night because there's this Olympic village. The Olympics were just there. But they built these shops and immediately emptied them. So there was about a quarter mile of beautiful stores that was nothing in. And so I'm walking, you know, I have like a bunch of Tsingtao in my backpack, I have a beard, I look gross. And this guy comes running out of nowhere and this mob catches up to him and beats the living crap out of him.
Wow.
So like I took a picture and I ran away. And then I went up the Great Wall of China, I went down another way, had to like sprint to catch a bus. But I'll put the picture, go to Movies, Films, and Flicks, look for this podcast post, and I'll put one of the pictures of me below it. Just for you readers to see this picture, because
next to the picture of Aiden.
Yeah, this one. Yeah, exactly. This one isn't that bad. Like, it's not that bad because I was like pretty fresh in my trip, but I look like a miscreant. So
I'm picturing you with like a bushy beard, a backpack full of Tsingtao, running up and down the Great Wall of China.
Dude, 6'4" in Asia.
Tsingtao was like a quarter out there, dude. It was awesome. I just put in my backpack and I walked around because they wouldn't let me in the clubs.
You were 6'4" and blonde and bearded and eight. They probably thought four just landed. Yeah.
But they wouldn't let me in the clubs. I tried to go into discos and maybe it was like the dress code or something. But
folks, and then, there you have it. Oh, go
ahead. That's my story. That's it.
I hope it was worth the wait. Right?
Yeah. And but there's no ghosts.
Yeah.
You know.
It was,
So you were in China, Korea, and Japan, all three of which are known to have their own, like, basically country-assigned sub-genres of horror. Not one grudge ghost, not one Korean haunting through an electronic device.
I was
not one vampire that knew ninjutsu.
There's two things. I remember one night, one of the first nights I was out there, I had a lot of soju in me, and I think I 100% believed it that I could punch a ghost. I like,
I remember going like earnest about it. Like, guys, if there's a ghost, I could hit it.
Mark, there was a night in college when we were in Tallahassee where I think we both thought we could beat the crap out of a ghost.
And then every time I went to Seoul, I would always look at the Han River to see if the host monster was running around. But that was it. No other experiences. Yeah.
Oh, God. Any other thoughts about this movie? I mean, not that we aren't just swelling with them, but are there any other like keynotes that we should touch on for, you know, reason number 46 not to watch The Forest?
It missed every mark.
Wait. I got one. So this whole movie started with the nonsense. Well, I won't say nonsense notion. I don't have a twin, but with the notion that I know something is wrong on the other side of the planet. I feel when my twin is distressed, right? Something very horrible has happened. So she goes the whole time, oh no, I sense her. I know she's scared, this, that, and the other. And then like when there's 20 minutes left in the movie, she's like, I don't sense her anymore. I know she is dead. So, but then at the end of the movie, after she fully hallucinates, thought that she was defending herself and ended up slitting her own wrist with like a box cutter or a little knife or something, right? And then she realizes that she did it and she dies. And then at the end, it's like a rescue team suddenly finds her sister within an hour of her killing herself in a hallucination after her sister was in those woods for a week. Like, they found her within an hour of that. And again, her twin, her like power twin, like psychic connection, if you will, was superseded by this grudge ghost forest magic.
The end, the twin sister sensed that her sister Dum Dum was dead.
But that makes sense because she was dead.
Yeah.
So why did the other sister? Like all of a sudden she was in the woods for all this time and never had the sense that her sister was dead. Right.
Is that like the Star Wars? They put up like a force field.
I don't know. Does the force just wear you down over time or something? Like maybe they could have gotten into that a little more. Like we kind of saw it happening, but it really took a big jump, right? When they started to get lost and then found that little like ranger outpost or whatever, like then it went from like a 3 to an 11 in terms of crazy and distrust. But I don't know, like that didn't sit super well with me. Like I was sitting there with another guy who kind of liked horror movies, and we just looked at each other at the end like that, you know, just that moment where of all the times you roll your eyes, that was the moment where we both looked at each other at the same time like, really?
Yeah, it was bad. Whole thing was bad.
Like that, yeah. Just that stuck out pretty hard. But it's not the worst like Americans in a Japanese horror that I've ever seen, because I recently saw Flight 7500 by Takashi Shimizu, who did the Grudge movies and the Ju-on movies, which were all fantastic in my opinion, or at least very entertaining. And this movie was garbage. So I will say that The Forest is now the second worst Japanese horror movie featuring Americans that I've seen.
Well, I will say you guys have effectively sold me on not watching the movie.
I feel like 7500 is the flight that was on its way to go to Japan for the movie The Forest, but it was so bad that it crashed and everyone died.
Yeah.
Ooh, and then a twin sister sensed it.
It actually pulled a Lost finale in late 7500. I'm not kidding. It pulled a Lost finale, which we know pissed people off as well. So.
Oh, gosh. All right.
The Forest. Natalie Dormer. Don't even go see it if you're a Natalie Dormer fan.
No.
Game of Thrones.
I think we have another listener question to get to, right? Living good?
We most certainly do. It is by Jesse's brother, or F's son. It's the third member of our listener question contributing family from Camden County, New Jersey. And Buddy asks, what character is only referenced in a movie that you'd like to see a spinoff movie made for?
I have an answer, and you're going to be able to guess it.
I'm going to be able to guess it?
Yeah,
I think I can kind of guess it, but I don't want to ruin it for you.
Wait, is it Ted? Is it Ted who has Ted's Island and Captain Ron?
No.
Well, that's a great one. Crap.
I didn't even think of that until just now. I just when you said you'll guess it, I thought of Kurt Russell.
That's better than what I have.
So that I don't. Is it someone that Kurt Russell refers to in a movie?
But no, I see by the smile on Laz's face over there, he thinks he knows who it is.
No. Laz, channel your power twin.
Demonstrate
psychic connection.
Listen, I think I know who it is, but I don't want to ruin it for Mark because I know.
Say it. Just say it. You might be wrong. It's okay. I was wrong. Say it.
Vern.
Yeah. Do it.
Huh?
Vern. Right?
Yes.
Oh, Vern, that's right from the Ernest movies. Say Vern.
Who else could it be?
Oh, I love that. And he's referenced so many times.
Yeah. Dude.
In so many movies.
Yeah, and like, all right, so you want to hear something crazy? The commercials that Ernest made when he was talking to Vern were so popular. There is a commercial where Vern would not let Ernest into his Christmas party, right? And Vern was being mean to Ernest, and Ernest almost started crying. I'm serious. Thousands of letters went to the marketing company who filmed those commercials. And they had to film one in a couple days where Vern says Happy New Year to Vern and blasts him with a pie in the face. It's like a 10-second commercial. But they had to put it on air because viewers were so mad that Ernest got mistreated by Vern. So then Vern got blasted in the face with something.
That's a good awesome. One. Shit.
I like Ted's Island, though, man.
Okay, so who's...
Yeah, listeners have heard this before, but I guess I should give like, the 10-second run. Like, so Captain Ron, Kurt Russell, is this totally, like, screwing up all over the place captain who doesn't know where he's going in the Caribbean. And Martin Short says, Captain Ron, I insist to know what our course is. Where are we going? And he says, oh, well, you know where St. Croix is? He says, yeah, I know where St. Croix is. He's like, oh, we're going to the island just to the left of it. It's like, which island is that? Ted's. he's just making stuff up as he goes. Like, it's some dude that he knows named Ted who has a little island. And so, like, I'd like to know, is there really a Ted, even if they weren't heading for it? Like,
I think there is. I don't think he's an outright liar.
Like, there's really a Ted, but he really didn't know where he was going. And he figured, like, Ted's island, I got a 50-50 shot of hitting Ted.
Because, like, remember when he said there's gorillas, right? And, like, he explains the engine. Like, when, like, that woman. I feel like he's pretty honest through a lot of it. Like, when he crashes a car, he's like, we got to go. But, like, you know, I don't think he's a pathological liar, Captain Ron.
No, yeah, I think he just doesn't know better. He just doesn't. He's optimistic and dumb at the same time.
He would show up on the island and he would go, "What's that line from Predator? Ted, you son of a bitch."
Oh, Dylan.
Yeah, Dylan, you son of a bitch. And then they do that high five thing, like on Predator, and the world explodes.
The aerial arm wrestling handshake,
inverted bicep bomb.
What's the matter? CA got you pushing too many pencils.
Lazabeth, what'd you come up with for this one?
It was actually Vern. I don't know.
Vern too?
Yeah. I don't know if you ever watched like the Ernest movies. Like, he's such a major character, but you never see him. I feel like he's just like a fiction of Ernest's imagination. Or figment of his imagination.
Hey, Vern.
Hey, Vern. I don't know. Yeah.
Oh, man. So I've got, like, a couple, sort of. Like I want to know the prequel story of the uncle who owned the cabin and found the book in Evil Dead. Oh, and all we get is the recording that he plays where he's narrating, like, he found the book. He reads the words. It infected Henrietta, and I had to lock her in the cellar. Like, but what really happened to that guy? I want to know exactly what happened to him and how he found the book. Is it like the beginning of Gremlins where he's in like this Asian market or something? Like, how did he come across this thing? Like, there's a story there, and I'm kind of surprised that with three Evil Dead movies, an Evil Dead remake, and now an Evil Dead series, that has actually still never even been glossed upon other than Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2 and then the Evil Dead remake, all citing the same example of the previous owner of the cabin and the recording, right? They're just reiterating the same thing.
I have a theory.
Ash is such an idiot. He sent it to his uncle and totally forgot about it. He's like, "Oh, this looks great. My uncle likes books. He likes leather bound books. I'm gonna send this to him." And then he completely forgot.
Is his dad Ron Burgundy?
Yeah,
he likes leather bound books. Ash, I sent him some bourbon.
Yeah, Ash completely forgot.
So, but here's another one, right? I don't remember what the exact number is. It's like, I don't know, 176 iterations over the course of a 99-year cycles. But in The Matrix Revolutions, the architect let us know that there were like 100 other The Ones. I'd almost like to see a fan film that just gives us glimpses of a couple of them who had events in their lives that broke off of the trajectory that Neo had, almost like a collage of stories that are linear in where they were in their development of the One, but you only see a scene of each The One,
like Jet Li from One, The One.
Well, so, I don't know. But it's interesting to me that they make that reference, and you're just like, wait, hold on. So this story kind of happened. The Matrix trilogy is basically a story that is a remake 100 times over.
Oh my.
Did 100 different The Ones fight the Merovingian and all of his weird little like furry friends with their weird weapons in his bar or restaurant? Like, was all that happening? Like,
not another one.
And don't forget, they even referenced in that there was a previous iteration of the Matrix itself, and that the Merovingians' henchmen were from it, so they were irregularly hard to kill. Remember? And they could break certain rules that even the agents couldn't break.
Wait, were they in the third one or second one?
They were in both. The second one. That was in the second one.
That was like the big house fight, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so like those guys, though, were really hard to kill because they were from an older version of the Matrix. So like, how did the trajectory of the story of the One go in the older iteration of the Matrix, like version one? What version are we on? Are we on version 1.1 or version 2.1, or are we on version like 8.2?
So why don't they just call them 100?
The 100? Then it doesn't sound special.
Just
anymore.
Confuse them like, you're 97. What?
Like,
you won't know until the end of the trilogy.
it opens up a lot of interesting little thoughts. I mean, I had a couple other ones, but they're really not as compelling. And so I guess – and you know what's interesting is that the Friday the 13th franchise, if you ignore part one, that's what it did. Because in part one, it was the mother, and it just referenced Jason Voorhees. And then they made – like 10 other movies to follow up our question.
Yeah.
To make 10 movies based on a character that was only referenced in a movie.
And her name was Ted, right?
If only.
Ted.
So I think Ted is the answer to that question.
Ted.
It's Ted.
See, Levengood, your answer gave us a good answer.
There you go. Ted.
We only give good answers, Mark.
So maybe in the iteration of MFF we're in, that was the one.
Yeah. Okay. Right. I don't know. let's quit while we're behind. thank you once again for a wonderful listening question. Mark, time to continue in this dark and woody path. See what I did there?
And we are going to talk... There? Oh, dark woody path.
Yeah. I don't know.
Oh, my God.
It sounds like life story of John Holmes.
You just put a good visual in my head. I didn't even want to talk. I just wanted to, like, let the podcast trail off while I thought about people walking. Yeah. So this one's actually a good movie. It was made in 2014, depending on where it was released. It's by Colin Hardy, and it is called The Hallow. It is an Irish creature feature / wooded horror film about this family moving to this small Irish town. He's going through the forest to plan for some deforestation, and the locals are like, hey, don't do it. Wait, they're not from New Jersey. They're from Ireland.
The locals are saying,
hey, don't, hey, what's he doing? No, that's Pikey. That's Pikey.
Can you imagine, like, he's like going the forest, like, oh! What are you doing here?
Ooh, 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 ooh. Irish. I can only quote lines from Patriot games. All right, so they're like, hey, man, don't do it. Because there are these things in the forest that will take your kid. You have a baby.
Wait, he's how old would she?
Take your little wee done to Dublin.
Yeah, and he's like, I'll be fine. Yeah. You know, I'll be fine.
Well, you know, he was like a PhD toting, I don't know, forester, plant pathologist.
Stoner. Like, yeah.
You know, like, he's just like, I don't believe in all your superstitious hooey. You grew up in a little town and believe in things that we don't believe in the city, kind of, you know?
Mm-hmm. In like,
but in the horror movies, we know that the superstitions are always true.
But the problem, though, is that this is all good. The actors, like, a lot of them are from Game of Thrones. What the director does is he does some very – it's interesting. You have about 20 minutes of buildup, and then it's all one final act, basically. Like, it's just not like a three-part structure for some reason.
Well, I'll call it three parts, but the first part is 10 minutes, the second part is 20 minutes, and the third part is an hour.
Yeah, there we go. And but it's basically like a siege forest, but it's basically revolving around the forest. You know, you treat Mother Nature bad, they'll come for you. And so it's just these people who get too involved, and he's cutting down trees, and he lives in the wrong place. And so they move to this nice house in Ireland. The wife, you know, understandably – takes down the iron bars around the house, which makes sense. Her name's Bojana Nokovic. She's from Devil, but you know, she's fine. She's just fine in the role.
That was the woman and the young girl in Devil.
So she takes down all the iron plants and whatever. And the guy goes out one day and he finds this dead dog and he takes a sample of this black goo that's on the dog. He looks at it under a microscope. He sees that it's very invasive. And what follows is a really great film about just protecting your family, an actual Irish miss. It's like Del Toro was actually given $5 million to make a movie and wasn't quite as preachy. You know, like, this is like a Del Toro movie, but Irish.
So Pacific Rim. Pacific Rim, but with Irish undertones.
Yeah, exactly. But in $175 million cheaper.
Yeah.
But the creature effects are amazing. And I've actually, you know, my favorite website, I think the best movie reviewers on the planet are from Empire Magazine. And they nominated this for their best horror film of the year. If you go through Fangoria, Dread Central, Bloody Disgusting. But then if you go through, like, you know, the mainstream things, everybody really loves this movie. Fans don't so much. It's actually like only 44% audience rated, which is insane. But it's a very thoughtful movie about just a family trying to save their kid. And it doesn't break new ground, but it does go pretty unexpectedly. Like, you know, there's a lot of body horror movies where the bad guy, where the father becomes infected. So actually, if you want to watch a movie, just watch it and then listen to this, but we're going to go into spoiler territory.
Oh yeah, I mean, this was that infection. I mean, it had elements of Splinter, specifically The Thing, The Cave, and District 9.
Oh yeah, and you know what's crazy though is the guy gets infected, but he's still good. But we
know that he won't be eventually. It's giving you that hint of like when what's the big Irish guy from Gangs of New York and Cavalry?
Oh, Gleason, Brendan Gleason.
Yeah,
Brendan Gleason. Like, remember when he had the drop of blood fall in his eye and 28 days later?
Yeah,
and he knew. He said, "Get away from me! Get the hell away from me!" Or like in a zombie movie where you've been bitten and you know eventually you'll turn and you're saying, "Just do it! Just kill me." But, you know, they prolong it maybe. Like, so he knows something bad is going to happen to him. He knows he's got a ticking clock.
But he wants to be there, though.
Yeah.
He wants to be there, though, to protect his family. Because these creatures, which are done, you know, really well, they're mean
they're basically like plant goblin chupacabra zombies. Yeah.
So there's this really neat scene. And what I like most about this movie is the lengths these two parents are willing to go to save their kid. And I think it's really admirable. There's a scene where this guy's driving, his car breaks down. He pops open the trunk to kind of look into it, and he gets knocked into it, closes it, and something starts harassing his baby. And this guy cuts the back seat open and slides through it like he's, you know, the back seat's birthing a grown man. But these parents, like, there's some very tense moments. And sometimes it's kind of weird revolving around children. But, like, these jerky forest creatures, you know, they want that kid. They want – give me that baby. As How Did This Get Made, Jason Mantzoukas would say, give me that baby. But I don't know. It's good. It's a good creature feature. The guy, Colin Hardy, was tapped to direct The Crow before all the problems happened. But it has heart. The creature effects are good. And like you said, John, that guy who got – he gets infected eventually, you know, trying to save his kid. Actually, he's looking through a peephole and something blasts him in the eye, which is awesome. But he wants to be there to save his family. And towards the end, his wife thinks he's going crazy, but he's right about some things. And then he goes, like, into the pit of, like, the layer of these things and, like, fights them and, like – oh, it's just, like – it's just – it's a good movie. It's a good creature feature.
I liked it, and it really – even though if you were to just take the first few scenes or even, like, what I call the next – the minute 11 to 30, what I call the second act, if you will. Like, if you even looked at that and then looked at the last 10 minutes of the movie, you'd be like, this is a pretty radical jump. But if you watch the movie, it really doesn't just, like, suddenly go off the deep end. Like I was saying, in the forest, it goes from some random stupid confusions of her believing in bullcrap, like people running in the forest, to total distrust and mania and sawing off her own hand or whatever. Like, it just goes crazy, right? This doesn't go off the deep end. It's like when it's a gradual drop, you know, you're never taking any leaps that shock you in terms of pacing. It's well staged in its descent into total pandemonium. And so in the beginning, though, what really got me is the power of the opening scene. The guys in the woods, right? The woods are gorgeous, but it's not super well lit. It has this ethereal feel, but it does have a feel that something bad could happen still. Not just because you know you're watching a horror movie. It actually felt like the woods in Legend after our introduction to the goblins. It's still a beautiful forest, but now there's a menace to it.
Yeah.
And it had this ethereal feel. I really feel like they nailed that, like, that sylvan, fey folk, Irish forest creatures, you know, fairy, like, but evil, if you will, like, habitat. They nailed the crap out of it. Mm-hmm. And then when he discovers it was a deer, when he discovers that deer that was infected, like, none of that was over the top to me. It all felt natural, his reaction. He was careful with it. It's not like he got it on his hand right away.
Yeah, he put gloves on.
Yeah, I mean, he treated it, you know, like he's a scientist. I don't know what this is. Even if it was harmless, I probably don't want this gunk on my hand. Whereas in a lot of these horror movies, even the ones that are half decent, they're just like, what's this? Panic, shock, get it all over my hands. Oh, this is gross. Rub it on my shirt and then
I'm going to take a bite of it.
I'm going to eat it. You know, I was holding the hot dog. I'm just going to eat this hot dog now. It has some black gunk on it.
Check out this black goo.
Ooh. Like,
Black goo. I liked the way that it went. There was only one scene that I thought didn't fit almost perfectly in this movie, and it did fit a little roughly to me. And that was when you pointed out that at some point he opens the trunk and it's like he got knocked out, like someone hit him over the back of the head with a sap. Because I was wondering, like, I figured that had to be a townsperson who somehow got into the woods. Because when you look at that behavior specifically, all of a sudden, for a moment, for one scene, we're going with the goblins in Labyrinth, where they just want the child and nothing else. But the rest of the movie after that shows that there was one point with this weird menacing hand. And this is why I reference Splinter and the Thing, how it transforms while it's reaching for Bojana's face.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it kind of blossoms. And then this little tendril comes out of the blossom, like a fungal spore or a pollen anther or something, like, to reach for her. It wanted to infect her. And they wanted to infect him. And when they infected him, at first they wanted to fight him. And then later when he was staying, their aggression was kind of a little mitigated. They were realizing he was almost one of them. So that's why that knock over the head didn't make any sense to me. And then when he gets out, there are these huge claw marks on the car. The door was open. They could, like, it's it just That, but and I'm not saying like, oh, pff, stupid movie. I'm saying really, 30 seconds of this movie didn't fit in an otherwise unwarrantedly amazing. This is a movie I never heard of. I watched this, not even seeing a trailer on your advice, and it blew me away. So hard recommend. No one listened to this thinking, John mentioned that stupid scene, Goblin King. It's stupid. No, it's awesome. Yeah. It's an awesome movie.
Ooh, and speaking of things wanting people, if you think of Mama, Guillermo del Toro produced that, and that movie is terrible.
Okay.
Not terrible. It's just so far.
It's a terrible film. It's not a good movie, but it's a. I think it's a very good horror flick.
It's a tank top horror film, Jessica Chastain.
It is, but it's a very entertaining flick. I can rewatch that. I enjoy it. I mean, there are some eye rolling things, but if you go in knowing that, I think it's pretty good. It's got some good jump scares.
Yeah.
You know, it's cheap tactic jump scares most of the time, but I liked it. I like that movie.
Like, I know we haven't talked about The Hallow much, but I just think it's just a good movie. Like, I like the idea of just protecting your kid. These people are urgent. Like, this, you know what they do is smart is they're going after your kid, so there's urgency there. This guy's infected, so there's urgency there. And then, like, then it's just like a mother going to get her child. And so what I always speak about with horror films is, like, there's always this urgency and dread going to it. You know, so there's things that have to happen in a certain amount of time. And that's what happens in this. And I really appreciated that structure.
Yeah. And again, like it ascended evenly. It did end up in a crazy place, but it got there with the appropriate steps. Whereas The Forest, again, it's almost like, hey, here's a movie where I'm just walking along and, oh, 89 goblins attacked me. End of the movie. I don't know. It's just like just some crazy. It didn't do that. It didn't pull any stupid fast ones on you like they didn't know how to stage the story.
Yeah.
It's hard to explain, too, because this movie really did, like, in the second in the last hour of these 90 minutes, it really did, like, cover a lot more than I think most movies could successfully handle, right? Because there's the introduction where our heroes.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot to break down.
That's the first 10 minutes, right? And the harbingers of the locals, right? Okay, so there's that. They got through that very fast, very convincingly, very effectively. And then the next 20 minutes, which I call the act two, it's the slow discovery. Something's here that my forester scientist can't readily explain. And, oh, crap, something broke a window. They're saying put the iron back up. And, oh, I took a photo and I saw that weird little humanoid thing with the glowing eye. You know, so now we know something's wrong, but this is not something that's easy to explain. What do most horror movies do at that point of discovery? All of a sudden they're like, oh, honey, I just saw some little monster. And, you know, and then all of a sudden, like, everyone – we know that that wouldn't come off well. You can't explain that. And he knew, even though they don't verbalize it, he knew that he couldn't rationally explain that to his wife, and he didn't quite know what he saw, so he didn't explain it yet. And then later, after the car incident, he explains that something's happening, but he's not being very specific. It's a little bit because he's harried and scared, but it's, I think, again, it's a little bit that they were taking the more real approach of, you don't just – in the Leprechaun movies, like, oh my God, there's an evil leprechaun. And once everyone sees it, it's as if everyone always knew that evil leprechauns existed. At first, like, oh, that's nonsense. You're just being silly and retarded. And then they see one, they're like, oh, we know that evil leprechauns exist now. Let's proceed. They don't do that. They don't make those stupid leaps. If you, Mark, discovered that vampires existed today and you saw one and it was trying to break into the house, there's no way for you to explain to your wife, Meg, honey, I realize this sounds crazy, but there's a real life vampire here to kill us. That would be more counterproductive than productive to protecting your family.
Yeah, like, get the guns.
Right, yeah, she'd just think you were crazy. She'd be calling the police about you. She would not believe you. And you're saying, be quiet, it's going to hear us. And she'll be speaking in a normal voice saying, honey, these don't exist. It's counterproductive. And he doesn't do anything that would be counterproductive if horror was real life. Even as crazy as this movie crescendos, it doesn't do any bullshit.
Yeah.
I love it. I mean, some people are going to watch it, and when they get to the end, they'll be like, he's a weird plant zombie hybrid thing. This is bonkers. And those little creatures are hovering around him as if to say, one of us won't join us.
Black goop.
I don't know. I'm sorry.
This worked. If someone says it didn't work, they weren't paying attention.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think if vampires were invading Mark and Megan's house, I think Mark would just be throwing out high kicks a la Sarah Michelle Gellar.
I would just line. They would just line up to get head kicked.
Whoop-oof. Whoop-oof.
I'd be like, hey, Megan, there's some goth people outside trying to attack us.
Hell no. What's his name? David Boreanaz is like kind of lingering in the background. Oh, yeah.
There's a bunch of brooding people outside our house.
Oh, man.
Man, they're brooding and they're wearing leather.
You know, and you mentioned the Guillermo del Toro thing. I'll say that this movie had this kind of primordial supernaturalness to it that I think that Guillermo del Toro nails pretty hard in his movies, too.
Yeah. And, like, yeah. And you know what's crazy? The older I get, the more these movies kind of affect me with like a couple with a kid. I watched the movie Backcountry. It's about this couple, really likable couple, being attacked by a bear. And then there is a movie called Honeymoon, which is a honeymooning couple. It's like a body snatching type movie. But
God,
like,
I still need to see that.
And like, but I watch it and like, I just watched Honeymoon. Like, you know, I was married for like 6 months. So it like, I started going like, man, if this happened to me on my honeymoon, you know, or like Backcountry, you like the couple, you understand this, why this guy would get them going into the backcountry. You know, he's trying to like impress her, you know? And like, but yeah, I don't know. The older I get, the more I'm into these. Like I watched Green Inferno and I hated every second of it because he's stupid college kids. So maybe I'm getting old.
That's what we were at one point. We were stupid college kids. Oh. Sorry if you're college kids who are listening, no matter how smart you are, when you're 35, no matter how smart you are today, you will think you were a dumbass when you were 22.
Yes, when I was in college, I was an idiot. Both these guys can attest to that.
I'm a government scientist. Mark works on film sets. Yeah. Like, and this is us saying we were dumbasses.
Morons.
I feel like if you guys would have still hated Green Inferno.
Yeah. Did you see Green Inferno, Lazbeth?
No, I didn't want to.
Oh, it's terrible. See it. Eli Roth, you know, a lot of people are saying, like, he's saying it. He made the movie to be like, it's about these people who get eaten by cannibals in the woods of, or in the forests of Peru. But he's saying it's about like Slack division, about people who just complain about activism on their computers and that's it.
Sure.
But it's about these activists who actually go to Peru and they're all, or, you know, terrible actors and their dialogue is horrible and everything's stilted and horrendous and you don't care about them. Then they get attacked by natives. Some guy gets eaten. Some lady has diarrhea. Natives get high. Some more people die. Like, it's
I don't know if I read this or heard this, but I mean, isn't he basically doing a contemporary throwback to Cannibal Holocaust?
Yeah, but it doesn't have like the balls to it. Like it doesn't. It's very – this is going to sound insane, guys. Maybe I've just watched a lot of horror movies and I'm just completely jaded. But there's nothing in it that makes you just – you know, you watch Bone Tomahawk. You watch I Saw the Devil. You watch these movies and maybe I'm just insane since I've been watching horror movies forever. But nothing in it was like – and the cinematography was like very crisp and bright. There was nothing gritty about it. Like The Hollow had some grit. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, yeah.
The Forest was like super HD, you know. But this movie, it's very – you don't like anybody. The violence – you know, Nicotero did the effects. He does Walking Dead, so they should have been amazing. But the problem is you don't care. Like remember in Hostel, the first one at least, you kind of liked the kids. Mm-hmm.
That was an effectively brutal move.
But this one – I think ever since he did that earthquake movie, Eli Roth, he got with his crew and they did like Knock Knock and then this. But there's this weird vibe to his movies and the actors aren't very good. They're all terrible people. You know, the violence, you know, a lot of people are saying how racist this movie is. You know, the natives are just straight up eating people. You know, it's very like, you know, he said he's trying to make fun of xenophobia. But it's just like these, like, and it's... it's not good.
Now I need to see this like tomorrow. Now I'm really
there's like big time, like, you know, there's this 5 minute scene where natives get stoned from like one bag of weed, and there's this lady who has explosive diarrhea, and like everyone's just jerks.
And I don't know. It's weird. Maybe I'm just conditioned to horror movies, but nothing about it made me.
No, hold on. We've been through this before, right? Like, our a movie's ability to impress upon us with, let's just say, without very stylish and crisp acting and filmmaking and writing, if you put that aside, a movie's ability to impress on us is really a consequence of our collective horror movie watching experience.
Yeah.
If you've never seen someone get their head cut off in the movie, the first time you see it, it's going to shock you, no matter how lame it is, right? It's just the way it is. If you've seen it happen 48 times, a scene is really going to have to get their shit together to impress you. So, but you see, we're saying this, right? And I agree with you. I understand what you mean, because I haven't seen the movie. I can't relate directly to this movie. But I've felt this for a lot of movies where it's like, maybe I'm just jaded. But hold on. Let's back up a second. We both just saw The Hallow when we're impressed all over the place. So you can still impress us. Yeah. Eli Roth just failed to.
It's not good, man. Like, you know, maybe it's good with your expectations being tampered, but it's just not. Watch I Saw the Devil. Watch Backcountry. Like, Backcountry's gore is insane. Honeymoon. Like, it's just, you'll like the characters. It's just
a bunch of dum-dums is what you're saying.
Yeah, dum-dum-dums.
Mark, like, please make a list of your top five dum-dum horror.
Oh, gosh, this is dum-dum-dum horror.
Also, make a list of your top five dum-dum flavors.
Dum-dum.
Yeah. But is Green Inferno really, is it fair to say it's comparably on the dum-dumometer to The Forest? Is that really fair? Because, again, I haven't seen it. I don't know. Like, okay. Is it really that far out there on the dum-dumness? Or is it more cookie-cutter dum-dum?
It's not cookie-cutter. It's just not good.
Like, okay.
Like, I see
because, like, in the forest, like, they were going full tilt trying.
Yeah. To with the dum-dum. But this movie with Eli Roth, I just think he wasn't trying to make his own film. I think he was idolizing other films.
Mm-hmm.
This was not organic at all.
Would it be fair to say that if you hadn't seen either, that Hostel is much more crisp and effective than this?
Yeah, because I liked the two guys. They seemed nice. They had personalities. They were kind of sucked into something.
And how about the violence and the gore? Like, I thought that was very effective in the first Hostel.
Yeah, and like the second one was gratuitous, and I hated it.
They made comedy out of it.
Yeah, it wasn't good. I think violence should be done to further a story. You know, the violence in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Violence should further things. I don't want a movie that just goes straight towards people getting
more murdered. Scenes of eating people.
Yeah. Like, like, you know, that scene in Bone Tomahawk when that guy gets ripped in half? That's like probably one of my least favorite parts of that movie.
You know, it's funny. Like, only after it started did I enjoy it and before it ended. But if I actually watched the whole thing, when I think about the whole thing, yeah, it didn't work for me, even though it was entertaining to me as a gore hound.
And, like, you know, there are movies like Hatchet, but those are movies that just are over the top. So that that horror is just basically showing, hey, look at these amazing special effects we have.
Yeah, and with that wraparound shot, with the woman getting her jaw ripped open, oh, my God.
That's more about having fun and showing, like, hey, guys, you know, because you don't take the murder seriously because it's just basically about the special effects.
That's the movie where it's not just the crazy gore hounds that laugh when it's happening. That's the movie where even if your girlfriend who doesn't like horror movies is grossed out and not looking, it's still like, ew, instead of, ah! Yeah.
And like we said, Deliverance, you know, that scene of violence furthers the rest of the film. That sets into play a chain of emotion, events. So this, what I didn't like about Green Inferno was just like, hey, we're going to move towards a centerpiece of death, and it doesn't do anything for the story because you don't like any of the people. So no matter how good the effects are on it, or if people are like, bro, man, I just wanted a cannibal movie and that's what I got, you're not really getting a cannibal movie because it's not original, it's not new. So I watch Backcountry. That violence is much more unexpected.
And the gore is insane. So, I mean, yeah, I don't know.
Or the remake of The Hills Have Eyes or Wrong Turn.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, the remake of The Hills Have Eyes. You know, there's that scene in The Hills Have Eyes where that kid finally becomes a badass and he kills that inbred thing, but he flips the axe upside down and kills it with the pointy end. That violence shows that he's been through the fire. You know, he's become, you know, a man who's going to protect his family. He's become a killer. That says something. You know, like, that's why Ebert loved, like, Antichrist. Like, Ebert loved that movie. When there's more to it than that. So,
right.
And it's not a bunch of dumb-dumbs.
Well, I think on that note, I think now's a good time to start wrapping up the podcast. It was a lot of good talk about trees and foliage.
Sorry for that tangent, guys. Loving good. Sorry if I talked over you. I just went on
solid
a massive
gold.
Rant.
That's solid
I,
gold.
I went on a rant.
That's all this podcast
like
is.
Like one of those machines that you put like a quarter in to get Skittles, and all the kid got were pearls.
Where are my Skittles?
Imagine that.
Where are my Skittles?
The parents are freaking out at the amazement of it, and the kid's just like, but my Skittles.
Bullshit.
Seriously. Well, before we sign off, are there any plugs you want to make?
Movies, films, and flicks. Rate, review the pod. The Lambcast, large association of movie blogs. Listen to their podcast. Also, check out the blogs on their site. And head over to johnlovingood.com, where he actually eats different pieces of pizza every day and then blogs about it.
Oh, nice.
I now would like to do that if it didn't cut into my movie time. Like,
just like do both, man. Idea. Just do both.
I don't think we've done it in a while. Do you want to give a quick like rundown for Shark Dropper?
Yeah, check out sharkdropper.com. We've got like a whole bunch of podcasts on there, 10 currently, right, last count, whatever. But I wanted to mention real quick, if you're going to see a certain big blockbuster comic book movie, Captain America 3, there may or may not be a scene directed by our very own Mark Hoffmeyer here.
Assistant directed.
Okay, we're allowed to say that. Okay.
Yeah, one shot.
One shot.
But don't. I'm not putting it on like.
Yeah.
Like.
Well, I'm
like,
not. I'm not gonna be specific about it. But
Are you allowed to say which scene it is, or do you have to hold that back?
But it's one shot that's like 3 seconds, and I worked on the film. Tiny bone got thrown my way. Yeah. But.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's neat. It's one of the biggest blockbusters of the year. Yeah. I got to relay directions to one of the actors.
I heard from Lazavath that it actually was like the keystone that brought the movie together.
It was.
I mean, it's pretty awesome. I've been working in the industry for a while, man, and like I haven't been this excited to watch a movie. And so
So when you're watching that movie, you just have to trust that one of those shots in the movie was AD'd by our very own Mark Hoffmeyer. So,
I'd like to give a little shout out to Jim Rothman. He's he just had a successful Kickstarter campaign complete at 9 a.m. this morning for a movie called Scythe. Ooh. And he had, you know, very earnestly asked me to write an article for him, and I did, and it was a brutally honest review, but I liked it. It was just brutally honest. And then I tried to help him promote it. I was one of the 1,000 little cogs that, you know, maybe made a difference in making his movie happen. But, you know, he was stressed out. Good for him, man.
You need to make Levin Good an associate producer.
Yeah.
I don't think he needs to make me anything. But
Associate producer.
If anyone wants to learn about it, he's Scythe Jim on Twitter, @ScytheJim.
Well, I stop at associate. What about executive producer?
And tell him John Levingood needs to be the associate producer.
You know what? I mean, he seemed grateful enough to include me among like 20 people that he tagged on Facebook. I don't know. So maybe he'll give us like first dibs on an early review screener.
Or thanks to John Levingood. First name on the thanks at the end of your credits.
Yeah.
I'd be happy with an early screener myself.
Yeah. Say thank you.
Jim Rothman, I'm going to make you listen to this.
Associate producer. They hand them out all over the place. It's like free giveaways at Oprah's show. They just throw them out.
Apparently they're like pearls.
Where there was a sexual harassment suit and Ari's like, just make her an executive producer on this latest blockbuster. We hand them out like candy.
Yeah, and associate producer. And on State and Maine, they're like, just make him an associate producer. So it's not that big of a deal.
Nice.
Associate producer.
to all you associate producers out there.
John Thunder Levengood.
Yeah. Shout out to all the associate producers out there listening.
I'm sure there are some that have done some. Yeah. You know what I mean?
No, not anymore. Okay. For my co-host, Mark Hoffmeyer.
Peace, love, dum dum.
John Levengood.
Mark just pulled the curtain and revealed an unimpressive Oz of associate producers.
I've been your host. Good night, folks. I've been your host and associate producer, John Lasso. Thank you so much for listening, and see you guys next time.
Allegedly, associate producers just get thrown out for legal purposes.
Above the target. T-minus 5 seconds till shark drop. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Drop the shark! Go! Go! Go!
This podcast is a Shark Dropper Studios production.